I'll begin by reading some early poems from my first book, Intellectual Things. I might say that title has been perhaps a source of some confusion about the nature of my work. Some of the critics have supposed, because of that title, that my work is primarily an act of cerebration. I don't feel that that's true at all. And on the contrary, I believe very firmly in a deep emotive base to the work. And furthermore, to a kind of order that contains as much disorder, as much association, as much dream, as much unconscious as the poem can possibly hold. My first poem is The Words of the Preacher. Taking infection from the vulgar air and sick with the extravagant disease of life, my soul rejected the sweet snare of happiness, declined that democratic bait set in the world by fortune's old and mediocre mind. To love a changing shape with perfect faith is waste of faith. To follow dying things with deathless hope is vain. To go from breath to breath, so to be fed and put to sleep, is cheat and shame, because by piecemeal living a man is doomed, I said. For time with clever fingers ties the knot of life that is extended like a rope, and bundling up the spinning of our thought, the ribbons and the lace that might have made a garment for the wind, constricts our substance to a cipher's space. Into the middle of my thought I crept, and on the bosom of the angel lay, lived all my life at once, and oh, I wept my own future to be. Upon his death-soft burning plumage wept, to vie with God for his eternity. I might say that in my own teaching of poetry, I generally advise my students against introducing angels, God, eternity, death, immortality, and all the grand generalizations into their work. In that particular poem, which was written when I was quite young, I think somehow I managed to get away with it. But I still remember what Gerard Manley Hopkins said about angels. Angels, he said, are the very cheapest things in literature. For the word is flesh. This is a memorial poem addressed to my father. O ruined father dead, long sweetly rotten under the dial, the time dissolving urn, beware a second perishing forgotten, heap fallen leaves of memory to burn on the slippery rock, the black eroding heart, before the wedged frost splits it clean apart. The nude hand drops no sacramental flower of blood among the tough upthrusting weeds. Senor, in this commemorative hour, what shall the quick commemorate? What deeds ephemeral? What dazzling words that flare like rockets from the mouth to burst in air? Of hypochondriacs that gnawed their seasons in search of proofs, Lesseus found 22 fine arguments. Tollet gave 60 reasons why souls survive. And what are they to you? And Father, what to me, who cannot blur the mirrored brain with fantasies of error, remembering such factual spikes as pierce the supplicating palms, and by the sea, remembering the eyes, I hear the fierce wild cry of Jesus on the holy tree. Yet have of you no syllable to keep, only the deep rock crumbling in the deep. Observe the wisdom of the Florentine, who, feeling death upon him, scribbled fast to make revision of a deathbed scene, gloating that he was accurate at last. Let sons learn from their lipless fathers how man enters hell without a golden bough. The next poem, entitled Night Piece, is an early experiment at incorporating the natural breath unit and idiomatic phrasing into the formal structure of the line. Night Piece. And everywhere, all over, men have sighed good night, remembering of women the bright of eyes, put out their bodies like a light, and set their brains adrift upon their blood. Let us be shy again, like feathered things, stroll in the gardens of the spectrum all last summer, waiting for the first snowfall, hear colors dropping, and the dark flurry of wings. Prevent that deepmost dream. Think late, think soon, of crickets, marvel, roses, and the bare shoulders of teasing Venus, and oh, the hair tumbling all over, everywhere, the moon. Up ever so many stairs, it is a new sweet look, it's morning, in each other's arms. Tell me, yes, I truly, by what charms have I been, darling, yes, I really do. I think that it is so, but if I scream out of my middle sleep, believe I saw the great fish tunneling the purple sea, earth darkening bird suspended over dream. The next series of poems will be from my Passport to the War, written in a quite different time, in a quite different sense of the world. I think this first poem that I'll read from that book gives some of the tenor, some of the values that I'm dealing with in that book. This poem, Welcome the Wrath, can be considered as partly a poem of dedication, that is, dedication to the art of poetry, and I suppose it can also be considered as partly just a plain old tantrum. Welcome the Wrath. Poor John, who joined in make of wrong and guessed no guile, dare I complain? Or practice to endure the heart unstrung, though waiting at the door too long, winter, wages, and self-disdain. Endure, that is the dialect of love, the greenhorn of the West, my late companion, now straggling crossfoot half alive, back to his country, with crazy sleeve flopping like a shot pinion. Let him endure. I'll not warp my vision to square with odds, not scrape, not scamp my fiber, though pushed by spoilers of the nerve's precision, bothered by caterpillars of suspicion, hired by speculators in my gut and labor. Wrath has come down from the hills to enlist me surely in his brindle generation, the race of the tiger. Come down at last has wrath to build a bonfire of my breast with one wet match and all man's desolation. The next poem was written as a birthday piece, my own birthday, although it's hardly a congratulatory poem. I had just been reading the Psalms of David, and I think some of the resonance, some of the rhythms enter into the making of this poem. The Guilty Man. The years of my life were odd that now are even. Think to be young, amused, and not a fool, playing the world's game, think, with world's own rules, and nothing lost, I think, but years. Heart against mouth is singing out of tune, night's whisperings and blanks betrayed. This is the end of lies. My bones are angry with me. Father, the darkness of the self goes out and spreads contagion on the flowing air. I walk obscurely in a cloud of dark. Yea, when I kneeled, the dark kneeled down with me. Touch me, my folds and my defenses fall. I stand within myself, myself my shield. Teach me my reasons, I would know their names, cry scandal, drive my secrets out, because I hate the good enough that spoils the world. Therefore depart from me, you virtuous men, whose treason is to turn the conscience kind. The souls of numbers kiss the perfect stars. The next poem of mine is, I suppose, the one that has been most anthologized and praised as a lyric. I call it a visionary poem, since it had its origin in the dream work, and when I'm asked to interpret it, I generally say I don't really know what it means, but I do really have some ideas. Open the gates. Within the city of the burning cloud, dragging my life behind me in a sack, naked I prowl, scourged by the black temptation of the blood grown proud. Here at the monumental door, carved with the curious legend of my youth, I brandish the great bone of my death, beat once therewith, and beat no more. The hinges groan, a rush of forms shivers my name, wrenched out of me. I stand on the terrible threshold, and I see the end and the beginning in each other's arms. Father and Son, my next poem, deals with a familiar theme in my work. The father image seems to be a central one, not only in its personal relationship to me, but because it stands for the whole tradition, the whole past, insofar as the poet may be able to use it. Father and son. Now in the suburbs, in the falling light, I followed him. And now down sandy road, whiter than bone dust, through the sweet curdle of fields, where the plums dropped with their load of ripeness, one by one. Mile after mile I followed, with skimming feet, after the secret master of my blood, him steeped in the odor of ponds, whose indomitable love kept me in chains. Strode years, stretched into bird, raced through the sleeping country where I was young, the silence unrolling before me as I came, the night nailed like an orange to my brow. How should I tell him my fable and the fears? How bridge the chasm in a casual tone, saying, the house, the stucco one you built, we lost, sister married and went from home, and nothing comes back, it's strange, from where she goes. I lived on a hill that had too many rooms. Light we could make, but not enough of warmth. And when the light failed, I climbed under the hill. The papers are delivered every day. I am alone and never shed a tear. At the water's edge, where the smothering ferns lifted their arms, Father, I cried, return, you know the way. I'll wipe the mud stains from your clothes. No trace, I promise, will remain. Instruct your son, whirling between two wars, in the Gemara of your gentleness. For I would be a child to those who mourn, and brother to the foundlings of the field, and friend of innocence, and all bright eyes. Oh, teach me how to work, and keep me kind. Among the turtles and the lilies, he turned to me, the white, ignorant hollow of his face. The next series of poems are unpublished yet in book form, but they will appear in my selected volume sometime within the coming year. The first poem I shall read is written in heroic couplets, somewhat different in tone from any of those you've heard. Basically, it's a satirical poem, an answer to some of my critics, perhaps, although it has no specific origin, actually. A choice of weapons. Reviewing me without undue elation, a critic who has earned his reputation by being always Johnny on the spot where each contemporary starts to rot, conceded me integrity and style and stamina to walk a measured mile, but wondered why a gang of personal devils need clank their jigging bones as public evils. The times are suited for the gay empiric, the witty ironist, the casual lyric. Apparently it's gristle fare, not fat, at certain tables. Must we weep at that? Though poets seem to rail at bourgeois ills, it is their lack of audience that kills. Their metaphysics but reflects a folly. Read me, or I'll be damned and melancholy. This poet suffers. That's his right, of course. But we don't have to watch him beat his horse. Sir, if appreciation be my lack, you may appreciate me, front and back. I won't deny that vaguely vulgar need. But do not pity those whose motives bleed, even while strolling in a formal garden. Observe that tears are bullets when they harden. The triggered poem's no water pistol toy, but shoots its cause and is a source of joy. I might say a few words about the origin of the next poem, since it perhaps implies something about the nature of poetry. The occasion for it was the spectacle of the wild geese flying overhead somewhere in Pennsylvania, where I was living at the time. I started the poem writing about the wild geese and made very little headway. And suddenly I realized that I wasn't interested in those geese at all, but in something that they did to me. And the moment I discovered that truth, the poem came. So the poem, as you will hear it, has only the faintest implication of the presence of the wild geese in the opening lines. End of summer. An agitation of the air, a perturbation of the light, admonished me the unloved year would turn on its hinge that night. I stood in the disenchanted field amid the stubble and the stones, amazed, while a small worm lisped to me the song of my marrow bones. Blue poured into summer blue. A hawk broke from his cloudless tower. The roof of the silo blazed, and I knew that part of my life was over. Already the iron door of the north clangs open. Birds, leaves, snows order their populations forth, and a cruel wind blows. The Science of the Night, the poem that's to follow, is a love poem and an astrophysical poem at once. Someone commented to me that I was the first poet to allude to the red shift, that spectroscopic phenomenon that scientists say tells us that the universe is expanding. But I think that's a rather irrelevant note. The important thing for the poet to be able to do is to incorporate everything he knows into his work, and he should know everything. And when he gets it incorporated into the work, into the structure of the feeling, then he can say that he has perhaps organized a piece of his world. The Science of the Night. I touch you in the night, whose gift was you, my careless sprawler. And I touch you cold, unstirring, star bemused, that I become the land of your self-strangeness. What long seduction of the bone has led you down the imploring roads I cannot take, into the arms of ghosts I never knew, leaving my manhood on a rumpled field to guard you where you lie so deep in absent-mindedness, caught in the calcium snows of sleep. And even should I track you to your birth through all the cities of your mortal trial, as in my jealous thought I try to do, you would escape me. From the brink of earth, take off to where the lawless auroras run, you with your wild and metaphysic heart. My touch is on you, who are light years gone. We are not souls but systems, and we move in clouds of our unknowing, like great nebulae. Our very motives swirl and have their start with father lion and with mother crab. Dreamer, my own lost rib, whose planetary dust is blowing past archipelagos of myth and light, what far Magellans are you mistress of, to whom you speed the pleasure of your art? As through a glass that magnifies my loss, I see the lines of your spectrum shifting red, the universe expanding, thinning out, our worlds flying, oh, flying fast apart. From hooded powers and from abstract flight I summon you, your person and your pride. Fall to me now from outer space, still fastened desperately to my side. Through gulfs of streaming air, bring me the mornings of the Milky Ways, down to my threshold in your drowsy eyes. And by the virtue of your honeyed word, restore the liquid language of the moon, that in gold mines of secrecy you delve. Awake! My whirling hands stay at the noon. Each cell within my body holds a heart, and all my hearts in unison strike 12. The thing that eats the heart is a poem that I don't think requires any comment. It's written out of a depth of despair, perhaps, desolation, and it tries to incorporate some of the sense of the pit in the poem. The thing that eats the heart comes wild with years. It died last night, or was it wounds before? But somehow crawls around, inflamed with need, jingling its medals at the fang-scratched door. We were not unprepared. With lamp and book, we sought the wisdom of another age until we heard the action of the bolt. A little wind investigates the page. No use pretending to the pitch of sleep. By turnings we are known, our times and dates examined in the courts of either or, while armless griefs mount lewd and headless doubts. It pounces in the dark, all pity ripe, an enemy as soft as tears or cancer, in whose embrace we fall as to a sickness, whose toxins in our cells cry sin and danger. Hero of crossroads, how shall we defend this creature lump whose charity is art, when its own self turns Christian cannibal? The thing that eats the heart is mostly heart. Among the Gods is a poem that appeared in Bottega Oscura, and God somehow came out dogs, and nobody seems to have noticed the difference, but it hurt me considerably. Within the grated dungeon of the eye, the old gods, shaggy with gray lichen, sit like fragments of the antique masonry of heaven, a patient thunder in their stare. Huge blocks of language, all my quarried love, they justify, and not in random poems, but shapes of things interior to time, hewn out of chaos when the pure was plain. Sister, my bride, who were both cloud and bird, when Zeus came down in a shower of sexual gold. Listen, we make a world. I hear the sound of matter pouring through eternal forms. The next poem is an extended single image, a conceit, if you will, in which a love or domestic relationship is correlated with a political situation. We'll see whether there's any reconciliation. Foreign Affairs. We are two countries girded for the war, whisking our scouts across the pricked frontier to ravage in each other's fields, cut lines along the lacework of strategic nerves, loot stores, while here and there, in ambushes that trace a valley's curves, stark witness to the dangerous charge we bear. A house ignites, a train's derailed, a bridge blows up sky high, and water floods the mines. Who first attacked? Who turned the other cheek? Aggression perpetrated is as soon denied, an insult rubbed into the injury by cunning agents trained in these affairs, with whom it's touch and go. Don't tread on me. I dare you to. Keep off and kiss my hand. Tempers could sharpen knives and do. We live in states provocative, where frowning headlines scare the coffee cream, and doomsday is the eighth day of the week. Our exit through the slammed and final door is 20 times rehearsed, but when we face the imminence of cataclysmic rupture, a lesser pride goes down upon its knees. Two countries separated by desire, whose diplomats speed back and forth by plane, portmanteaus stuffed with fresh apologies, outdated by events before they land. Negotiations wear them out. They're driven mad between the protocols of tears and rapture. Tell me no lies. We are divided nations, with malcontents by thousands in our streets, these thousands torn by inbound revolutions. A triumph is demanded, not moral victories deduced by small advances, small retreats. Are the gods of our fathers not still demonic? On the steps of the Capitol, the outraged lion of our years roars panic, and we suffer the guilty cowardice of the will, gathering its bankrupt slogans up for flight like gold from ruined treasuries. And yet, although the murmur rises, we are what we are, and only life surprises. Locked in our fated and contiguous selves, these worlds that too much agitate each other, interdependencies from hip to head, we coexist, economy sustained by perpetual crisis, which fires our furnaces, ripples out our flags, makes drunk our orators, and lastly rolls us into salvation's bed, until we cry with the passion of history, straining through our five senses. Now the nights are wild with our imperial marches, flank on flank, within the circle of old mysteries, our torches tossing on the roads before, and kindling moon webs and dazzle stuff in trees, amid the rank fetor of the brindled beast, we spoil with destiny, and with our spoiled hearts blazoned on the east, we love our chances, pressing towards the war. The war against the trees is certainly in its theme self-explanatory. In a way, it's another look at modern man, at the tradition. I'm deliberately using here a quite modern idiom, perhaps to avoid what might be the sentimental traps of the theme. The war against the trees. The man who sold his lawn to Standard Oil joked with his neighbors come to watch the show, while the bulldozers, drunk with gasoline, tested the virtue of the soil under the branchy sky by overthrowing first the privet row. Forsythia forays and hydrangea raids were but preliminaries to a war against the great grandfathers of the town, so freshly lopped and maimed. They struck and struck again, and with each elm a century went down.
All day the hireling engines charged the trees, subverting them by hacking underground in grub dominions, where dark summer's mole rampages through his halls, till a northern seizure shook those crowns, forcing the giants to their knees. I saw the ghosts of children at their games, racing beyond their childhood in the shade, and while the green world turned its death-foxed page and a red wagon wheeled, I watched them disappear into the suburbs of their grievous age. Ripped from the craters much too big for hearts, the club roots bared their amputated coils, raw gorgons matted blind, whose pox and scars cried moon on a corner lot, one witness moment caught in the rear-view mirrors of the passing cars. A Spark of Laurel is a poem written in short line, 3-beat line. And I think that the source of it is really of no consequence. But another poet, really, was the occasion for it in something that he said. And what he said is contained in the first few lines of the poem. A Spark of Laurel. This man, this poet said, I've carried in my head for 20 years and more some lines you wrote before I knew the meaning of Euripides or love. And gravely then intoned, lured from the underground, the Greekness of my song, still melancholy young, while she, long since forgotten, for whom the song was written, burned wanton once again through centuries of rain, smiling as she must do to keep her legend true, and struck the mortal blow, but not that blood could flow. Ha! Once again I heard the transubstantial word that is not mine to speak unless I break. The spiral verb that weaves through the crystal of our lives, of myth and water made and incoherent blood, what sirens on the coast trill to Ulysses lost, and Agamemnon's thigh opened at length to cry. This laurel-sparking rhyme that we repeat in time until the fathers rest on the inhuman breast that is both fire and stone, mother and mistress, one. My last poem is based on the Oedipus myth, but it's a very free version of it. Oedipus is the speaker of the poem. I imagine him at the moment after his encounter with the Sphinx. He has answered her riddle, disposed of her, and now he's moving towards the gates of Thebes to encounter his disastrous fate, which involves, as you all know, marrying his mother. The approach to Thebes. In the zero of the night, in the lipping hour, skin time, knocking time, when the heart is pearled and the moon squanders its Uranian gold, she taunted me, who was all music's tongue, philosophies and wildernesses breed, of shifting shape, half jungle cat, half dancer, night's woman-petaled, lion-scented rose, to whom I gave, out of a hero's need, the dolor of my thrust, my riddling answer, whose force no lesser mortal knows. Dangerous, yes, as nervous oracles foretold, who could not guess the secret taste of her. Impossible wine! I came into the world to fill a fate, am punished by my youth no more. What if dog-faced logic howls? Was it sphinx or sphincter magnified my joy? Nature has reasons beyond true or false. We played like metaphysic animals, whose freedom made our knowledge bold before the tragic curtain of the day. I can bear the dishonor now of growing old. Blinded and old, exiled, diseased, and scorned, the verdict's bitten on the brazen gates, for the gods grant each of us his lot, his term. Hail to the king of Thebes, myself, ordained to satisfy the impulse of the worm, mummied in those famous incestuous sheets, the bloodiest flags of nations of the curse, to be hung from the balcony outside the room where I encounter my most flagrant source. Children, grandchildren, my long posterity, to whom I bequeath the spiders of my dust, believe me, whatever sordid tales you hear, told by physicians or mendacious scribes, of beardless folly, consanguineous lust, fomenting pestilence, rebellion, war, I come prepared, unwanting what I see, but tied to life. On the royal road to Thebes, I had my luck. I met a lovely monster, and the story's this. I made the monster me.